Morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Before this merry month of May is succeeded by the two J's, A and S, sounds almost like a word puzzle for John Jacob Astor, a few major instances of mayoral impacts upon our Pacific Northwest hysteria age. I begin with something I wrote, and virtually the whole program is everything, or something I wrote. Hail Columbia. I start with a quote from Thor Heyerdahl. Europeans go around the world saying they are the harbingers of civilization, but it was Africa and Asia that civilized us in the beginning. And as prologue, before anything, you must remember that when the American ship Columbus Reborn entered the river that bears its name in the robust spring of 232 years ago, a culture that vibrantly dwelled on both shores for maybe 20,000 years at that moment began to become extinct. The history we celebrate is our own cultural history. That which we supplanted has generally been ignored as insufficient, not worth popular study, until recently. Now, a few generations removed from their obliteration as hemispheric monarchs, we are interested in them. So new are we that we might be regarded as a pustule growing from the skin of a leathery 20-millennia culture that was decimated by its parasitic visitors. We know little of their history, assorted myths, and a few bones to fill in the vast gaps of time in broadly general rather than individual narrative. When Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, he thought he would have a straight passage west around the world to India and trump the competition by opening up the riches of Asia for his employer, the newly reestablished Christian monarchy of Spain. Instead, he bumped into a rock, and for 300 years, Europeans looked for a waterway through it, a passage west to the east that connected the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. Ever since the Crusades of the 11th and 12th centuries, Europe was hungry for the silks and spices of Asia. The Christian hordes were greedy for pagan wealth, but were unsuccessful taking it by conquest. The Saracens, as the armies of the cross called them, once they expelled the infidels, were more than happy to trade with them. Europe's gold and silver in exchange for Asia's silk and spice. For centuries, the only door to the east from the west, and vice versa, was through the narrow Mediterranean, the Middle Sea, and the merchants of Venice, who trounced their rivals Pisa and Genoa for a virtual monopoly as go-between. In the 15th century, when Ottoman sultans ruled almost all of Western Asia and Eastern Europe, including the once magnificent Byzantine Empire, the first of the great Atlantic seafaring nations, Portugal, sent its small sailing ships to explore the end run around Africa to the rich ports of India and China. It took them nearly a century to round the Cape of Good Hope and sail into the Indian Ocean in 1498, 6 years after the great navigator, and that's in quotes, collided with the Western Hemisphere. Columbus, who was an unemployed mariner from Venice's rival Genoa, first tried to convince the Portuguese that it would be easier to reach India by sailing west across the Atlantic Ocean. Spain, which had just kicked out the last of its Muslim North African conquerors and re-enfranchised its medieval monarchy, was anxious for global wealth and power after seven centuries of foreign occupation, and hired Columbus, who, as it turned out, underestimated the Earth's circumference and had not calculated the presence of the American continents. Spain, though disappointed that India was not so easily reached after all, built a world empire on the riches of American civilizations it destroyed and the gold and silver it mined with the forced labor of incorrectly named Indians and black African slaves. England and France came late into the action of looting the Western Hemisphere, and although ancient rivals, each was determined to undermine the Spanish Empire. Each independently sought a passage through North America to Asia, primarily because Spain controlled the South Atlantic. Papal bull split the world between Spain and Portugal until the former consumed the latter. But Francis Drake got through the Straits of Magellan at the bottom of South America, and after raising a great fuss, sinking Spanish ships and sacking Spanish settlements, sailed up along what is now the Oregon coast, looking for the Pacific entrance to such a Northwest Passage in 1579. How far up he came and where he stopped to scrape his ship's hull is disputed, and almost every developer building a condo in a cove hires a historian to claim Drake landed there. Even the Nehalem River Valley is claimed to be Drake's new Albion. What is not disputed is that he sailed across the Pacific Ocean in a single ship, the Golden Hind, to get back home to England because fleets of angry Spanish were waiting for him on his back trail. 9 years later, Drake played a major part in wrecking a large Spanish fleet that intended to invade England, called, even today by sardonic Spaniards, the Invincible Armada. That English victory in August 1588 began England's long rise to world power. Along the way, it colonized and lost a strip of Atlantic seacoast in North America to rebellious colonists who declared themselves a new nation and immediately set off to grab a large share of Asia's bounty for itself. Hopes for a Northwest Passage to the Pacific through North America faded over the centuries. Spain lost its lengthy supremacy, and ships from the northern European nations took the long ways around Cape Horn and Good Hope. But a new legend replaced it. Now there was thought to be a great river of the West, which was said to be called by Native Americans the Oregon, among other names. People thought the Missouri River was navigable to the Rocky Mountains, and after a short portage, the Great Western River could be reached and traversed straight to the Pacific. But, like the Northwest Passage, no one could find this great river. The great English explorer James Cook sailed past it in bad weather in 1778. 10 years later, in 1788, another Englishman, John Mears, a freelance entrepreneur, tried and gave up, naming Deception Bay and Cape Disappointment to discourage others who might follow him. And George Vancouver and his royal expedition were just off the mouth of the river in 1792, but were deceived, as was Mears 4 years earlier, by surf breaking across the bar. The Spanish explorer, Bruno Heceta, thought he had found the river in 1775, which he named the San Roque, but was unable to get in because his crew was too weak from scurvy to man their ship across the tempestuous bar. In the spring of 1792, the same year Vancouver sailed past, on May 11th, an American from New England, Robert Gray, took his ship, Columbia Rediviva, Columbus Reborn, through the wild surf at the bar and entered the fabled river, which he named Columbia after his vessel and the great admiral of the ocean sea himself. This 24th year of the new millennium century, the nations of the Americas commemorate the 532nd anniversary of Christopher Columbus's first voyage in search of India. Some celebrate, others bitterly denounce the intrusion of Europe upon the Western Hemisphere and the consequences of half a millennium of conquest and epidemic. The intense eruption of controversy resembles the dispute between intellectuals of the 18th century, in which Rousseau, Voltaire, et al. Argued that the European discovery of the Americas had cost millions of lives and the wholesale destruction of native culture, and was thus a blight upon the history of civilization. A smaller, less controversial acclaim is paid Robert Gray and his claim of discovery of the fabled River of the West on May 11th, 1792. Yet the consequences have been a microcosm of all that Europe accomplished or ruined in this half of the world. Almost immediately, white Americans and Europeans came in Gray's wake to trade, to settle, to supplant, and eventually eradicate native culture. The great river has itself been tamed with dams, the massive forests on both sides of its banks logged and replaced with cities and farms, and the millions of salmon, which until only recently were so numerous it was claimed a person could cross the wide river on their backs, have dwindled to only an endangered few. The exchange of a natural wilderness for a human wasteland is relatively recent. The Pacific Northwest has been a last small corner for Western exploration, with the exception of the poles and Antarctica. Gray opened up a major portion of the last frontier, yet the annual celebration has less to do with his discovery of the Great River than it does the present and future generations of native strangers who dwell among the vanished ruins of a fatally vulnerable culture our predecessors overran. The present tenants of the Columbia River Basin inherit a legacy of raw exploitation and waste. The riches once so abundant have been despoiled, virtually all used up in only a few generations. Even the big river has not escaped the pollution of modern society, known as one of the most radioactive rivers in the world, as a result of Hanford plutonium and Trojan nuclear waste, and it is a garbage dump for towns and cities along its banks. Industrial pollution is a major offender. The present generation is bitterly divided about Gray's legacy, and each side of the controversy utilizes extremes in its arguments to exploit or preserve. On the one hand, it might be considered that a great civilization has reached its maximum westward movement on the North American continent in the Pacific Northwest. On the other are the extreme environmental damages which an expanding population and its technology have wrought upon the landscape. It is unfortunate that what remains of Gray's legacy is coveted by the nation at large, including the water of the river itself. It is likely that the decisions have already been removed from local say-so. Just as likely, a massive earthquake that is predicted for some time soon will rearrange the region into something very different. Hail, Columbia. And now, something else I wrote, the prettiest mountain. The way popular history has of getting things confused, it will probably be common knowledge in a few years that Harry Truman, who was once president of the United States, died in the spectacular explosion of Mount St. Helens on May 18, 1980. At least 60 people died in that blast, which had the fury of several nuclear bombs. Thousands of animals were killed. Entire forests were obliterated. Spirit Lake disappeared. Mudslides and log jams flooded the Toutle River and knocked out several bridges. The Columbia River Channel had to be dredged because mud washed downriver blocked ships. Eastern Washington was covered with volcanic ash as far as Spokane, and pumice littered ocean beaches. Millions of tons of dust was hurled into the sky, and it was thought a ring of dirt and smoke would form around Earth and reduce sunlight. Mount St. Helens was the prettiest mountain in the Pacific Northwest. Its shape was almost a perfect cone, like Japan's Mount Fuji, and was usually wrapped in snow. The first eruption was in late March 1980, and there have been numerous others in the 44 years since the cataclysmic May 18th blast, though none have approached its intensity or destruction. Lately, the mountain has been quiet. No one is certain if it has shut off its fires or preparing for another blow. Walt Curtis wrote in an article for the North Coast Times-Eagle in June 1982 that male TV newscasters spoke of the St. Helens volcano as being an unruly female and told a corny joke, "Do you know why St. Helens erupted? She didn't take her earth control pills." Curtis said his 65-year-old mother responded, "They're so stupid. The volcano is really named after a male, an obscure British ambassador whose first name was Allen, spelled in an old-fashioned way. I must admit I have always felt this gorgeous mountain possessed a feminine quality," Curtis wrote. "The Klickitat Indians also thought of the volcano as a woman. She was Luwit, the snow witch, consigned by the Great Spirit to reside in snow and ice. Uneasy magic has always been associated with St. Helens." Miners in the 1920s claimed they were attacked by a family of Bigfoots, hairy apes. These apocryphal creatures threw rocks and broke out the windows of their cabin. In March 1980, as the mountain began to rumble, spew ash and soot, belch pumice and broken ice blocks, we never dreamed these minor eruptions would come to a cataclysmic conclusion. Every time I look toward the north, enjoying the spectacular scenery of the snow-capped peaks of the Cascades, known as the Ring of Fire, I see one lone, decapitated natural shrine observing the serene and beautiful sentinel leveled by a cosmic bulldozer. My thoughts become gloomy, Walt Curtis said. Harry Truman, who was not president, but was a drinking companion of Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, became an authentic folk hero when he refused to leave the mountain that had been his home for half a century as proprietor of the popular Spirit Lake Lodge. He might not have thought he would actually die, but that is incidental to legend. He will most likely be remembered, eternally linked with Mount St. Helens, as the man who exploded with the mountain. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.